Accession number 30419, reel 14.
So we've talked about the some of the social side of things. We talked about the embassy.
Yes.
So we were going to start with the actually moving it into Borneo and the supply drops.
Yes.
Maybe you can take me on the journey from one to the other.
Yes. A couple of details that I've looked up the official record of the evacuation of the embassy. And on the 19th of September, as I said, there was the one Hastings and the three Arguses. And it said we evacuated 55 children, 97 adults, and £3,500 of freight. So that gives you some idea of the number. A lot of children there, far more than I would have remembered, I think. And then on the next day, another Argosy went back. And then on the 2nd of October, there were two Hastings and two Arguses went back, so another four aeroplanes, and all in all, 274 people were evacuated. So that was that, and that was when there was no further overflying of Indonesia, and all the British nationals were evacuated. Let battle commence. Now the war was never declared. It was always termed confrontation, which was a kind of an euphemism. Both sides wanted to keep the thing low key. The Sukarno reckoned that he had the Americans and world opinion on his side. As I said, since his independence in 1949, he'd got his 85 million people together, which comprised 17 ethnic groups, and he really thought he would make this Mafalindo work. He was a bit surprised when the Federation was declared, and the thing which had been boiling since the Brunei rebellion the year before, he kept on the boil, and the Allies built up their reserves, brought in more aeroplanes, the Arguses, for example, and fighters and bombers and photo reconnaissance aircraft, more soldiers, and the Navy. The Navy was there in force, a couple of aircraft carriers. The whole thing was building up, but the spark came really at the a police station in Sarawak, which was called Tebedu, that was on the 12th of April 63. That didn't quite light it up. That was between the rebellion and the evacuation of the Jakarta. So there were hit and run stuff through that year. But then on the 28th of September, a couple of weeks after the evacuation of the embassy, the base at Long Jawe was attacked. Long Jawe, up in the Sarawak Hills, close to the border, and it was there were no Indonesian regulars involved, but there were certainly Indonesian irregulars, and they were still using the local population the people who didn't like anybody, really, who saw in Sukarno a support for their general discontent. And so they sacked the police station and the police station and the base at Long Jawe. And the people were taken by surprise, and the guy in charge, who was Major General Walter Walker, who was a Gurkha man and SAS man, who was based in Brunei at this time, he had his headquarters in Brunei, formed a joint headquarters so he can coordinate the whole effort, and decided that what had gone wrong at Long Jawe was that they didn't have the local intelligence telling them what the movements of the guerrillas might be, and also he needed to whistle up reinforcements, so he needed close support from the helicopters and the Twin Pioneers, the short strip landing aeroplanes from the RAF, and he needed the Gurkhas and the SAS on the ground winning the hearts and minds. And so what happened at Longjiangwei in the end was that they did get the Gurkhas in, and they went up to the border where the Indonesians were sure to retreat, and that did the trick. They captured or killed a lot of the Indonesians. And so it was a show of force at Longjiangwei by the Allies, but they needed to be a bit more clever than that. So Walter Walker set up this system of strong points and air supply. Bear in mind, it was an 800-mile border, which was, and most of it mountains, so it's very difficult to defend that border. There were 6,000 Indonesian regulars on the frontier. We had one man for every 400 yards, which was pretty thinly spread. 400 miles of jungle, it means it's not defended. So he set up a series of forts, rather like they had done in the Malayan emergency, which had worked very well. And these were ringed with barbed wire, with stakes, and with some mines. And they had radio contact, of course, with not line of sight because of the mountains, but they could relay through the aeroplanes that were flying around. And they had the ability to reinforce at a moment's notice, I mean as soon as possible, with Gurkhas primarily, who were extremely effective. If you could whistle up a couple of helicopters full of Gurkhas, it makes a big difference to the balance of power with irregulars in the jungle.
Why are they so good?
Well, they're trained for that sort of work. They've been the Gurkhas were used in Burma within some effect in the Second World War, and they were extremely good at moving quietly through the jungle, which is an art. I can't do it. So they're small little brown men, without meaning to be offensive at all. They blend into the jungle background. They look a bit like natives. They've got tremendous powers of self-sufficiency. We used to drop chickens, that comes later, and they'd tie a live chicken by its legs to the belt and take it into the jungle with them. So they had fresh meat. They lived off the land much more easily than the British soldiers. I mean, a Gurkha will eat your grubs and your anything else that comes to hand, whereas the British soldier relies on a tin of bully beef, really. And they were fearless and ruthless. The 1VC that was won in theatre was won by a lance corporal in the Gurkhas, who did an extraordinary job under fire of relieving one post and rescuing another and silencing another machine gun. They're that sort of people. So the SAS were extremely effective as well, but they were, of course, looked like Englishmen, looked like Tommies, and didn't quite merge in quite so well. And they were also ruthless and very, very good. So these strong points were set up, and of course they had to be resupplied from the air. There were no roads to these strong points. Most of them didn't have a river either, or if it was a river, it wasn't navigable. It was rushing stream. The rivers in Borneo can become raging torrents in a morning if you get the monsoon break and the rain pours down. So they're dangerous anyway. So air was the only way, and the air supply would then bring in all the fuel for the close support helicopters, bullets, bully beef, the whole lot. Some of the strong points had a landing strip, and where that was the case, then at Long Somado, for example, one of the up front, very near the border, but it had a landing strip, one of these wooden affairs built by the missionaries and the oil companies. And there you could get a twin Pioneer in as well as a helicopter. But a lot of them just cut DZs in the jungle, not much bigger than a cricket pitch. If you were lucky, you got a cricket pitch to drop in. And you had to drop those in from transport airplanes. What used to happen was that the supplies would be brought in by ship, Royal Navy, to either Kuching, which was in Sarawak, the capital of Sarawak, and or Labuan, which is an island off the coast of Brunei, where there were port facilities. The supplies would then be broken down at Labuan on the airfield, Kuching on the RAF base, by the Royal Army Ordnance Corps into packages or containers which could be dropped from aeroplanes.
What kind of containers did they use?
They used one-ton containers, which was 2,000 pounds, short ton, and they were mostly, if they were going to take supplies, they were wooden crates. If they were going to take fuel, they were four 42-gallon drums of kerosene strapped together. And if they were going to take barbed wire or stakes for building the strong points, we had pallets, and they were all dropped by parachute. The Hastings couldn't drop one-ton containers. The Hastings and the Beverleys could, but the Argus and the Beverleys could. But the Hastings dropped harness packs, which were known as SEAC packs because they were developed in Burma by Southeast Asia Command in the Second World War. And they were 200 pounds, so a tenth of the weight. And they were dropped by parachute out the side doors. The harness packs were dropped from 500 feet and the one tons from 700 feet. There we are. As far as I remember, there was another airplane in theatre as well, the Valletta, which had done sterling work in Malaya in the emergency, and they were there. They came down from Butterworth. I could tell you these squadrons if I can find the right page in this excellent book.
Your own excellent book.
No, I don't think I can.
No, there's no rush.
Darn it. I thought I'd put it in here. Anyway, I'll tell you all the squadrons a little bit later.
We can stop for a minute and you can find it. Okay.
And the 52 squadron from Butterworth, and they used to drop harness packs as well. Later on in the conflict, when the New Zealanders came in, we had the Bristol Freighter from 41 Squadron Royal New Zealand Air Force. Harness packs again. So once they were broken down into these containers, they were... A lot of the stuff, of course, wasn't put in the airplane at all. It was shipped up river. Couldn't drive very many places. From Kuching, there was a road which went down towards the border. That was used, but everything had to be broken down and go by river, which meant canoes. Some of these canoes were quite substantial affairs with a powerful outboard motor. But once you got right up river, it was the locals paddling in their dugouts, basically. I mean, if they were cooperative. So quite a lot. They moved as much as they could up into the country, but there were no mules like there were in Burma. All this had been done in Burma, so they were picking up the practices that had been done there. And in Burma, they had to carry mules, which were 12 in a Dakota. Imagine it. A riotous affair in some cases, because a mule is an ornery beast that can kick forwards as well as backwards.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, boy, oh, boy. And they took hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of mules in Burma. We didn't have to put up with that. But we did carry a lot of live chickens, not quite the same thing.
Was that difficult?
It was in some cases. The chickens themselves would sit in their crates and just accept their fate. But the crates sometimes broke up because they weren't the strongest of things, and then the chickens were on their own. And at one stage, in order to save on crates, we tried dropping chickens free fall. It didn't do the chickens or anybody much good, so that was abandoned. So where they couldn't take it by river, then it had to be dropped. So the RAOC packed up these containers and the harness packs with everything. I've got a video of the guys doing this, and they're putting cabbages into these crates. So even cabbages, because the guys need vegetables. It's essential to have vegetables. And you can't grow much in the jungle. It's very poor soil, except in, the natives exist on a slash and burn method. So they'll cut down enough jungle to be able to cultivate primarily rice, but some other leafy vegetables. And then they move on because the land's exhausted. It's very poor soil, and they're finding that these days with the deforestation, that there's not an awful lot more you can use apart from date palms, the soil for. So we had to take everything that was needed by the soldiers.
Can you tell me a few, what other kind of things were in there, apart from cabbages? Can you remember anything else?
But there were...
And chickens.
There were chickens, there was bully beef, bullets, of course, and toilet paper, everything you can imagine that a soldier needs to live his life. But for the Argus's, the first thing howitzer shells, a lot of howitzer shells, because they found that and mortars. In the jungle, you need the guns that throw the projectile up high, get it above the trees and back down again. So we used to take a lot of shells, and the prime thing that we came in to do was to drop fuel. So 8 one ton containers of fuel. This was positioned up in the strong points to refuel the helicopters primarily. You could also and the Twin Pioneers, of course, they needed refueling because it's a big place. The 800 miles of border, but the island is the fourth biggest in the world.
Is it?
Yeah, it's huge. It's I looked it up this morning and I've forgotten it. I think that there's Australia, of course, is the biggest. And one of the Indonesian islands, Greenland, and then Borneo. It's very, very big. And so the flying, you go a long way. I mean, imagine that. It's if you were flying, it's 400 miles from Singapore to Labuan. Sorry, it's 800 miles from Singapore to Labuan. It's 400 miles from Singapore to Sarawak. That means if you're flying from here to Edinburgh, and from London to Edinburgh, that's 400 miles. So if you're doing that in the Twin Pioneer, use a lot of fuel. And if you fly from Sarawak up, from Kuching up country, you're doing a 400-mile round trip. So you need fuel refueling when you get there. And helicopters particularly, because they use a lot of fuel when they're flying at low level, which is all a helicopter does. We used to take starter fuel for the helicopters as well. It's called Avpin, if I remember rightly, and that's a very unstable fuel. It's got a it's liable to combust. Fortunately, it didn't, but you have to handle it very carefully to make sure it doesn't.
Well, there's the special procedures to handling it.
I wasn't really... no smoking, of course. I mean, that was the first thing. So if you had fuel on your aeroplane, nobody lit up. I think we probably did in the flight deck, but not downstairs. And you just handle it carefully. The Arguses were called in to the theatre, really, on 215 Squadron. In fact, 215 Squadron was reformed in order to reinforce the one-ton container dropping resource. The only other aeroplane to do it was the Beverly. And the Beverly, which is a magnificent aeroplane, has big engine reliability problems. One in four takeoffs of the Beverly in theatre, they lost an engine or had some engine problems and had to abandon. It's powered by the Bristol Centaurus, which is the biggest, most complicated piston engine ever built. Extraordinary thing. Did I say this last time?
No, you didn't. I'd have remembered that, definitely.
Yeah. It's got a propeller twice the height of a man. I mean, it's got four of these engines. There's a walkway along the wing, or more accurately, a crawlway, and the flight engineer would spend a lot of his time crawling down to get to the engines and pump oil into various parts of it. It could go backwards on this engine, so it could put its propellers into reverse, which is a great facility in tight parking places, but added more complication and more push and pull rods in it than you could count. It was an extraordinary beast, and so they needed reinforcement. They could drop twice as many one-ton containers as we could on an arrangement of rails. They had a double-tier arrangement of rails. They left the back doors off, double-decker aeroplane, the Beverly, very tall, and they'd leave the back doors off, and then they could drop these one-ton containers out at the back. And I think they could drop them in a string, but that must have given hideous trim problems, so I should think they probably tried to avoid that. Of course, if you dropped them in a string, they'd be all over the jungle, so you had to drop them one at a time.
In a string?
All at once, one after the other. Daisy chain, I think it would be a more accurate description. So they were pushed. They were operating out of Labuan, which is this island 800 miles east of Singapore, and the main supply dropping base for Sabah, which is on the north east tip of Borneo, was then a crown colony of North Borneo. On independence, on the creation of the federation, it became Sabah. So the Beverly is operated from up there, off the island of Labuan. The Hastings operated from Kuching. It couldn't drop. The Sabah is much more mountainous than Sarawak, and the Hastings couldn't get down low enough to drop and get out again, basically. So it used to drop harness packs from the side door. One side door it had, and mostly down at Kuching. We operated at both bases because we could drop harness packs from the side door and one tons out the back. All right, and it was in October of 63 that we did our first detachment up to Labuan to fly alongside the Beverleys, and I was on the crew. My captain was squadron leader John Leary, who was one of the flight commanders, and he'd been on Beverleys, and he'd taken the precaution of persuading his mates on the Beverly Squadron to take him into the DZs beforehand, which was extremely helpful. I mean, I could, it's so fresh in my mind, this first detachment.
Can you just literally talk me through it?
Yeah, all
from
right.
From the beginning of the day.
Yeah, but we would... Labuan was beginning to develop, and by the time we got into the depths of confrontation, it was a substantial camp. But when we went there, we were lodging in the local Membadai club, which was a shell club. All right, but one or two of us had to sleep in the corridors on camp beds. The ground staff were living in tents, and when they were servicing the aeroplanes, our ground crew, and there were one of six disciplines out there on detachment with us, had converted Beverly Pistol Centaurus engine boxes into temporary accommodation right out by the aeroplane to service it. It was, of course, extremely hot, 90 degrees in the shade and 80 plus humidity. So very difficult working conditions for them. And they did a splendid job because they had to get up very early and get the aeroplane ready. The REOC usually worked at night, packing up the containers and getting them onto the aeroplane. They used a forklift truck for that. They were £2,000, you can't carry that. So they used to put them into the aeroplane with a forklift truck. So we would go to briefing in the early morning after breakfast. Gets light at about 7 o'clock. So you can't fly before... Well, you can. We did fly at night, of course. But generally speaking, we would wait because... up in the jungles and the mountains where we were going to drop, in the morning until the sun gets high, the valleys are full of mist anyway, mist and cloud. So you can't go there. You have to wait until the mist clears. Then, as the sun gets higher, so by the afternoon, it's boiled up all this cauldron into tropical storms. And you don't really want to be dropping in tropical storms. A bit dangerous, that.
So there's quite a small window in between.
So there's small windows. And it wasn't like this all year round, because you get the monsoonal changes. But generally speaking, you just had to try and fit in between the weather. And we usually did two trips a day. So if we took off at 9 o'clock and flew for an hour to where we were going to drop, by that time, 10 o'clock in the morning, you've got a chance. Get your drop down, hours dropping, come back for an hour, that's 3 hours, it's lunchtime. You have a lunch, and then you take your chances with the tropical storms in the afternoon.